This is the English Heritage Podcast.
Hello, and thanks for joining us for this latest podcast into England's past. I'm Charles Rowe. You can subscribe to receive new episodes every Thursday, and if you'd like to leave a comment or a review, we'd love to hear from you. Today we're talking about a subject that all of us are familiar with and that comes with all manner of historical vocabulary. This includes latrines, privies, rereadorters, guardrobes, and even thunderboxes. Joining us for a journey into how people went to the toilet in the past are senior properties historian Dr. Michael Carter and freelance historical archaeologist Dr. Ian West.
Hello.
Hello, it's great to be with you. And I think today we're going to be getting to the fundamentals, or should that be fundament, of history.
Exactly. We have to try and keep our giggles at bay on this one, I think. And thank you as well to Dr. Ian West for coming on as well. First time speaking to you, so appreciate you being on. Let's get in with the first question for you then, Ian. How did people go to the toilet before modern engineering methods?
Okay, well, this is not my sort of period of speciality, but fundamentally, before the Roman period, people were living in very small communities, and they would have set aside a dedicated area outside their community, effectively, with a trench or something like that, where they would have deposited their waste, a bit like the latrine trenches some of us can remember when we went camping when we were young.
Do you think this would have been in sort of a wooded, secluded area?
Could be anywhere, I suppose. I mean, I think probably concerns about privacy are a relatively more modern concept.
Okay. Would people from prehistory also have to be careful about keeping their waste away from watercourses?
I don't think people understood necessarily about sources of water so much, but clearly from ancient times there was a recognition that human waste was a contaminant, so you had to ensure that it didn't contaminate your food and drink. Yes,
I suppose the clue is in the smell, really, isn't it? Because it's not nice at all. When we think of the past, would everything have stunk to high heaven then, do you think, Michael?
Really, really interesting. And I think part of this is a kind of snobbery of chronology, that Baldric the Dung Gatherer from Blackadder speaks to some popular perceptions of history. Now, first of all, our modern obsession with body odours and smells and things like that, well, it's relatively new. You know, it's like, you know, Life Boy was developed as a soap in the Victorian era as a way of getting rid of body odours and things like that. But the first effective deodorants and antiperspirants are well within living memory. So yes, there would have been more smell, but people were probably not as dirty as we often think. That there has long been human recognition that it is not a good idea to be filthy. And although even I'm going to be talking about monasteries, although there was this real thing about, you know, early Christian hermits despising the flesh and not bathing, that probably had more to do with a rejection of ancient Roman luxury than it did with some idea that being caked in filth was a good idea.
Okay.
The frequency of bathing was much less regular than it is today. And monks, you can't really use monks as a general example, you know, but it's something I know about, so I'll talk about. They bathe 4 to 6 times a year. That's is not very frequent, is it, by our standards? But that didn't mean they didn't wash.
Intriguing. We'll get on to that then. But going back to the main subject of making waste, animal dung, of course, is a good fertiliser for crops, as any farmer will tell you from history. So does human waste actually have any useful applications, Ian?
Certainly. The euphemistic name for solid waste is night soil, and it was a highly prized commodity, and in some parts of the world it still is, I think, and it was used to improve the fertility of soil, although care had to be taken to allow time for it to decompose in the ground or on the surface of the ground for the bacteria and parasites to die off. Urine was perhaps less valuable as a fertilizer, but the chemicals it contains have been used since ancient times to make cleaning materials and for fulling cloth. Urine was collected and saved for processes like that. And also from the medieval period, urine was a useful source of chemicals for making gunpowder.
Really? And leather as well, isn't it? It's used in the leather-making process?
Many sort of proto-industrial processes would have used urine as a chemical in, as I say, tanning of leather would be one of them.
In the history of controlling human waste, then, which group of people had the best technology? We've already talked about the Romans. Did they have the best, do you think, in the ancient world?
Well, they're certainly amongst the best. I mean, the Romans excelled in hydraulic engineering. They constructed magnificent channels to convey water great distances from its source to their communities, their cities, and their military settlements, and so on. And so they were able to use the flow of water through the latrines to wash away the waste. So the Roman latrine was basically a bench with a hole in and a stream running underneath it, and so that the stream would wash the waste away. They didn't invent it, actually. I mean, it goes back to the Greeks. One of the best examples anywhere is actually Ephesus, which is a Greek city, so something like 100 BC, where there was a building with stone benches around the edges, 36 holes in these benches, and a stream of water running underneath to wash the waste away. So going to the toilet in those days was something of a communal activity, certainly for the men. The women wouldn't have used facilities like this. They would have used a chamber pot in their houses. But yes, yeah, so if coming nearer to home, Halsted's fort on Hadrian's Wall has certainly got a very good surviving example of one of these Roman communal latrines. I think there was something like 12, or there's space for 12 people to sit and do their business.
Would they have been facing each other, or would they have been backs to each other?
Facing inwards, yes. So that the same as Ephesus, that you looked at each other while you were going to the toilet.
So I suppose it was a communal and social thing in a way.
Yes, like bathing for the Romans. You know, the Romans had a big, big sort of bathing activity, and these latrines were often part of these complexes.
As we sort of move forward through time, the Romans leave and we're into the early medieval period. What happened to toilet technology in those centuries, so the 400s and onwards, Ian?
The sophisticated water supply systems built by the Romans fell into decay. So like a lot of things, life took a step backwards. People didn't live in such large communities after the Romans left. So things would have gone back to how they were before in this country, before the Romans came. So people living in small settlements, using latrines at that time. Later, in sort of in the early medieval period, you get larger communities, towns growing up. And so the residents there would probably have had their own, or groups of houses would have had their own privies, which is just a shed with a bucket or a trench or whatever, which they would use, and they would empty their chamber pots into as well. These containers would be emptied from time to time. Coming back to the night soil that I talked about earlier, people would have collected the contents of these receptacles and used the waste on the surrounding land. So you start to see the growth of private facilities in the early medieval period.
Okay. And in these settlements, it's just a question of, as you say, a latrine, which is basically a hole in the ground where people communally go and deposit their waste.
Or you get to the point where you'd have a privy, which might have a seat and a container, which would be obviously easier to empty the container than it is to dig the contents out of a pit.
This privy, would it have been sort of a wooded structure that people would go into?
Yes, a little wooden shed, which might have been shared by a group of houses or dedicated to just one large house, perhaps might have had its own privy. And people were using these sorts of arrangements right through until the 19th century.
So possibly from the late 400s AD to the late 1800s?
I would say not as early as the 400s, no. I think we start seeing the growth of towns a bit later than that. So perhaps around 700, 800 AD, something like that, you'd start seeing people living again in settlements we would regard as villages and towns.
Where are some loos in monasteries and medieval castles that we can see today? And could you describe them, Michael? And we should also tell our international listeners that loo is what sometimes English people refer to as the toilet or the lavatory. So just in case anyone's not native English.
And also for non-English visitors as well, there's a real class distinction about which word you use as well. Loo is sort of nice middle class and higher way of describing your necessary space, whereas toilet was considered a little bit too working class kind of thing. And it still permeates, a class still permeates English society. There was one of the Mitfords wrote something on you and non-you language. Loo was very definitely you, and toilet was, well, definitely day class A. But anyway, I'll be talking something about presently about the terms which we use in the Middle Ages, but there are some really fascinating examples of latrine arrangements at our English Heritage castles and monasteries. I'll say something about the castles first. And Dover Castle, there is some excellent medieval ensuite facilities. Goodridge Castle has its own latrine block. Old Sarum Castle, well, you can see latrine arrangements which were fit for a medieval king. And there's also Orford, a urinal. But when we get to the monasteries, my word, there are some fantastic monastic latrines. And ones that in the English Heritage Estate that shout out to me are Castle Acre, Revo, Battle, and Muchelney. And I will be talking about all of these in more detail. And you have these enormous great latrine blocks, as well as some more private ensuite privy facilities as well.
Okay, so there's quite a broad selection there from various parts of the country. So I think you mentioned Goodridge Castle. That's a Norman medieval castle ruin in Herefordshire in the Midlands. Then you've got Orford Castle in Suffolk. That's near Ipswich. Dover Castle is in Kent.
Yeah, and Old Sarum, that's on the outskirts of Salisbury.
So that's Wiltshire, southwest England.
Yeah. Oh, and also should mention Peveril Castle in Derbyshire, where there is a latrine shaft hanging off a cliff face. You know, that's a very common location. You can see them sometimes on some medieval city walls as well, of a latrine. It's all built in stone on these walls, but there's a kind of projecting privy, the waste discharging down the side of the walls and into ravines and moats and such like underneath.
And also, in some castles, wouldn't you have also had a sort of overhang where...
That's exactly what I was talking about, yeah.
Ah, right, okay. Yeah. And that's where the waste would drop out. But
yeah.
Would one see the waste, or would it be within sort of like a chimney?
You do occasionally get one where there's a chute with a shaft through which the waste would discharge. But often, once it leaves you, it's going to be visible to the world. And I imagine some of these city walls were stained with excrement.
So where did the waste go after it was either seen or not seen?
Well, it's a number of places that, you know, some medieval monasteries, and I think we'll be talking about this presently, have very, very sophisticated water management systems for the latrines. The communal latrines are over watercourses, either natural ones or ones which have been engineered to carry the waste away. And sometimes they go into a latrine pit, which has to be dug out. And we'll be talking about some examples of both types of waste management later in the podcast, I think.
Your specialism, Michael, is monasticism, monks and nuns. Mm-hmm. How did monastic toilet facilities develop over time? Were they any different from the ones that you would see in these castles and that sort of thing?
I think that monastic plumbing, monastic latrine arrangements are probably some of the most sophisticated arrangements for the management of human waste that you had before our relatively modern times. There are some excellent monastic latrines, but there's a whole range of facilities weren't used as well. And yes, they did very much change over time. We know early hermits, the sort of 3rd century, 4th century desert fathers, the deserts of the Middle East, it just seemed to have been like latrine pits. And taking their inspiration from the book of Deuteronomy, which basically says, you know, you dig a pit and cover it up. And we have some really interesting evidence from English Heritage sites or individuals associated with English Heritage sites about waste management at Anglo-Saxon monasteries. There is a brilliant story about St. Cuthbert and his hermitage on Inner Farn and his shed for the necessities of nature. Medieval monks loved euphemisms to describe going to the loo. It was basically over a ravine which was washed out by the tides. And he needed a piece of wood for a latrine bench. And the monks from Lindisfarne, who would come and visit him, forgot to bring it. And then by miraculous means, a piece of wood, the perfect size for St. Cuthbert's latrine, was washed up on the shore the next morning. So here we have the miracle of St. Cuthbert's holy latrine bench, the holy toilet seat. You know, if it still survived, it would have been regarded as a relic of St. Cuthbert.
Yes, we should just explain as well for people who haven't followed the Lindisfarne episodes and St. Cuthbert and the spread of Christianity that Innisfarne is an island next to Lindisfarne as part of a series of islands called the Farne Islands up in northeast England off the northeast coast of Northumberland. So for anyone trying to imagine what that situation was like, it would have been, well, at least a very solo way of going to the loo because he was the only one there or he was among a small number of people. But you're going to continue, Michael, with another monastic toilet.
And that's another hermit. It's St. Godric and St. Godrich and his hermitage at Finchal, which is about 3 miles away from Durham, again in northeast England. And he has his shed where he attends to his necessities, but it causes such a stink that apparently St. John the Baptist, who is very much a patron saint of hermits, comes and tells him that he has to move it.
Ah, the spirit of St. John the Baptist, I suppose.
It's a vision of John the Baptist.
A vision.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then from certainly the 9th century in Europe, you get planned stone-built latrine blocks. There is a plan dating from the 3rd decade, I think, of the 9th century, from a monastery in what's now Switzerland of St. Gall. And it shows various latrine blocks for the use of the monks, for visitors, for the guests, and for the servants as well. And we have good evidence of these latrine blocks, stone-built latrine blocks, at monasteries in England from, the late 11th, 12th century onwards.
Now, one thing that people who know about and nuns will be keen to know is how did they organise their lives around going to the toilet, going to the loo, because obviously they've got quite a regimented routine of prayer and worship and various other tasks. So did going to the loo sort of almost be a bit like going to the loo at school, which was make sure you don't interrupt class to go to the loo, that you do it in break time sort of thing?
Well, if there are any fans of the Big Bang Theory listening, comedy from, about 15 years ago it started, there's a character in that, Sheldon Cooper. Sheldon would have been very, very pleased to hear about their regularity. The Rule of St. Benedict, which is the basis for monastic life across most of Europe, from certainly the 8th century, 9th century onwards, says that monks should attend to the necessities of nature between the early morning services of matins and lauds. But I think it's also important to add that the monastic rule of St. Benedict's and other things were one thing. There was also an appreciation that, well, things happen and you were permitted to leave church when you're singing the services or another task to attend to your necessities, if that was indeed necessary. And it's interesting as well, the word that was used from the 9th century onwards for monastic latrines was necessarium. And another word that was used for it, certainly from the 15th century, is rara dorta, which basically just means at the back of the dorta, which is the dormitory. And you do find these monastic latrines strategically located. They're attached to the main living block in the monastery for monks and nuns. And it must say that most of the evidence here in England does come from male monasteries. So if I do occasionally give gendered answers, it is just reflecting the nature of the evidence we have. These latrine blocks are always attached to the main residential block of the monastery, which is the East Range. The first floor of the East Range has the dormitory, and they often have ingenious in and out systems for the necessarium or rara dorta. One door in, one door out. There's a lamp left burning in the dormitory at night to help guide monks and nuns to the rara dorta, the necessarium, if they need to use it during the night. And they are brilliantly planned as well. They are masterpieces of architecture, sanitary design and engineering.
Okay, so how would they have appeared then? Would they have been a bit like the Roman seating arrangement, or would they be all along a wall, you know, these holes? Yep. With seats?
It tends to be that the row of seats is along one side and they are partitioned off. And there's a description of the latrines at Durham Cathedral Priory. It's made after the Reformation, but it's recalling what the monastery had been like on the eve of its suppression. And it describes how the latrines there have this wonderful wainscoted boards dividing the stalls. These are positioned above a drain beneath, or in some cases a pit beneath. They're stone built. They're at first floor level, so the waste drops down quite a way. Castle Ake is really interesting because they have a two-story arrangement as well. It's possibly latrines on the lower story for use during the day, or it could be a reflection of the size of the community. Some monasteries have, gosh, it's almost a stall for every two monks within the community. So they have thought this out, that, you know, if you're going to demand that people go more or less the same time every single day, then you're going to have to make provision for that, which they do.
Yes, they sound very sophisticated, as you've been describing. Just one other sort of off-piece question that I'm curious about. You mentioned that they would be in the east range, so the eastern side of any site. Was that also planned because obviously the sun rises in the east, sets in the west, therefore you won't get sun shining onto the building and causing a real stink, or at least you'd minimise the stink?
Smell is definitely a concern. But no, it's just because it attaches to the church, the east range of the church, east bit of the church where they need to get into to sing the services. Occasionally, because of topography, you'll get a dormitory attached to the western bit of the church. But, you know, it's all to do with planning arrangements. But it's all about, but, you know, on the whole, it's all for the convenience of the monastic day. Monks and nuns need to have very, very easy access to the church. They have to enter the church in the middle of the night to sing what's called the night office between midnight and about 2 a.m. And their choir stalls are situated in the eastern parts of the church. So it's as simple as that. Stench, you talked about stench. That really is an issue. Now, we know from Westminster Abbey that they have to make emergency repairs to some drains there because of the stench issuing from them, from the privies, the waste discharges into the privies. And also in the Middle Ages, well, you know, smell, bad smells become associated with bad things. And what the very worst thing in the Middle Ages is the devil. And the devil is accompanied by foul smells, and so are evil, rotting revenants, sort of bodily corporal ghosts rising from their graves. They're associated with terrible, terrible smells. So the smells that emanate from monastic and other latrines often get allegorized in monastic writings about being indicative of evil and bad. And also, you know, latrines are of reminders of visiting the latrine is a reminder of your flesh, of you being a human. And, well, you know, your flesh is a potential vessel for sin. And there are very, very strict rules about how monks and nuns are meant to behave whilst seated on the latrine. And visibility of hands is very important. And you also have in monasteries kind of equivalent of school prefects and snitches. They were called roundsmen. And one of the buildings that they would patrol, especially after monks and nuns were supposed to have gone to bed, was the rara daughter or the necessarium, to mention there was nobody hanging out there and up to any, you know, misdeeds. And there was also this thing of, like, you know, there were also cases of people falling asleep whilst on the loo. And also there's some monastic sources mentioned that while seated on the loo, it's a good place to get down to a little bit of reading.
Which has continued throughout history, I think. Newspapers and paperbacks and whatever you want to take in with you. On our visit to Rievo Abbey in North Yorkshire in episode 171... we learned about its sophisticated water management system, and the monks built a network of pipes using water from the nearby River Rye and local springs to support their domestic and agricultural activities. Did a lot of medieval monasteries take a similar approach to toiletry because of their topography, that they had access to these watercourses?
Yeah, I mean, siting a monastery close to a good, reliable source of water, well, it's essential. And whenever possible, they will do it. And the location of the cloister, it's normally on the south here in Northern Europe, and that's to get as much sunshine as possible. In southern Europe, it tends to be on the north because shade's more important. But the cloister will be so located so as to get the most of the water supply. You know, Rivo is an excellent example of water management at a site. Diverting rivers, building canals, creating canals for various purposes, so for drinking water or cooking water and ritual water for blessings and such like, and then also water to cleanse the drains. And you also get really sophisticated forms of water management, building sluices, which they can build up ahead of water, release the sluice, and whoosh, it all goes through and gives the drains a good old flush.
What if you didn't have good flushing then? What if you didn't have a good water supply?
Well, it's a case of the monks would often throw their hands up in horror. And a good example is Battle Abbey, which is William the Conqueror commands is built on the very spot where he won his great victory, which is on the top of a hill. And there is no natural water supply for it. And the monks are horrified. We don't want to found our monastery here. Until, you know, William very much conquers them. And you know what? They had to muck out their latrines by hand. And the monastery's accounts, financial accounts, gosh, between the 13th century and the 16th century, they record regular payments. I think it's sixpence a day, not a bad wage, paid to local labourers for the scouring of the latrine. Another place where that might have happened is Mutchelney Abbey in Somerset, which, although it did have a water supply, it wasn't very good. It was via conduits. And as at battle, you have these series of arches where the latrine drain is, so people could get in and muck it out by hand. Battle's also great because it's one of these places where you can see these more private privies associated with higher class rooms. And they similarly at battle, well, it was a case of people getting their spades and digging it out.
Did the waste that was collected then get used on the fields, etc.?
It's a case of supposition. I think, you know, what Ian was talking about there, you know, it's a valuable agricultural commodity. I know it's one of the reasons why in earlier generations, until very recently, people thought that vegetables had to be boiled to within an inch of their existence was because the potential for their contamination with waste products, be it human or animal. It was partly a hygienic requirement of, you know, taking a lot of extra effort to clean produce from fields.
Speaking of hygiene, how did one deal with hand washing, Michael?
Monks and nuns would have washed their hands more often than anybody else probably in medieval society. Gosh, up to 10 times a day they would wash their hands. Every single time they went into church to sing one of the offices, you have a ritual washing of your hands. And similarly, when you enter the refectory or communal dining hall. Now, as I said, it's a kind of ritual washing. And, you know, it's not the kind of hand washing we understand for the removal of, you know, the chances of bacteria on it and things like that. The discovery of germ theory is very, very recent indeed in human history. But there's also a sense that, you know, filthy hands are not a good idea. People in the Middle Ages were as disgusted by stench as we were, and the presence of excrement on something was not thought to be desirable at all and to be avoided as much as possible. So, you know, I'm sure there would have been determined efforts to remove kind of any obvious hand contaminant. So I think, to be honest, that, you know, the hand washing arrangements in monasteries were, you know, and you have these glorious fountains built in cloisters or attached to the outside and troughs outside refectories where people would have washed their hands before ritually at certain, you know, it is to an extent ritual, but also, you know, it would have had some benefit in terms of hygiene. So I do think that there is something going on there that might have been protective. And, you know, enteric disease, you know, diarrheal diseases were a major cause of illness and death and, you know, leading cause of death until relatively modern times. But one thing that strikes me that medieval manuscripts, liturgical manuscripts, including the, you know, the manuscripts for Mass and the Divine Office, you often find annotated on them various medicines. And you do sometimes find something, you know, for the binding of the bowel. That's basically a diarrhea treatment. But more often you find treatments for constipation. And it seems that, well, constipation rather than diarrhea was a bigger concern for, or they would have called diarrhea the flux. You know, that seems to have been a bigger concern for monks than, I think, you know, the constipation rather than diarrhea. I mean, it's just my supposition of the manuscripts I've looked at, but it might tell us something.
I think it's amazing that they even wrote about these things.
Oh, monks were martyrs to their bowels. You know, and I think, you know, this is where Alan Bennett, you know, he does talk about the monastic latrines in his hit play, The History Boys, which was made into a film. But he wrote an article, oh gosh, 10, 15 years ago, about a visit to Rievaulx Abbey just after Christmas, and he had to jump over the fence because the monastery was closed. I think we let him off for it. But he is absolutely fascinated by the latrines at Rievaulx. And I think that does speak to a human, and wider human fascination to, well, the necessities of nature. And it's a testament to monastic engineering that water is still running through the main latrine drain at Rievaulx, and not just there, but several other monasteries as well. Gosh, the 800 years or more after their construction, they would still, with a bit of maintenance, be doing what they were built to do.
One has to ask, for people who know their history, what happened to these monastic facilities after the dissolution of the monasteries in the 1530s to 40s?
Yeah, really, really interesting. That Battle Abbey is a very, very good example. Things which people just don't think are worth saving when the monastery is being dissolved, they just throw down into the latrine pit. It is waste as far as they're concerned, as much as the human waste beneath. Some of them are given other uses, like the latrine block at Muchelney Abbey is converted into a barn, and that ensures its survival. The one at, it's not an English Heritage Site, the Lay Brothers at Kirkstall Abbey, their latrine block survived and was also put to an agricultural use. And I can remember visiting that as a little boy. One of my earliest memories, actually, probably about 1970, 1971, it was then used by Leeds City Council as a cafe for visitors to Kirkstall Abbey. And I can remember almost retching in disgust when my dad told me that up above had been the monastic loos.
Having covered pretty well, I think, certainly the monastic way of going to the toilet in the past, we can now sort of move the centuries forward a bit and start talking about how toilet technology takes its next step forward. When was that, Ian? And are there any key names associated with this new development?
Right, well, the earliest known attempt at making something resembling a flushing toilet was 1596, and the man concerned is called John Harrington, Sir John Harrington. In fact, his family lived in Somerset, a place called Kelston Hall, and his mother was one of Queen Elizabeth I's courtiers, ladies-in-waiting. Queen Elizabeth, because she didn't have any children, she had hundreds of godchildren, and John Harrington was one of these numerous godchildren of Queen Elizabeth I, and he became a courtier as well as a poet. We don't really know where he got the inspiration for his flushing toilet, but he wrote about it in a book called The Metamorphosis of an Ajax, which includes a nice little drawing of this device, and it's got a water tank and a bowl and a tap. So you turn the tap on, you go to the toilet in the bowl, and turn the tap on, and the water from the tank flushes the contents of the bowl down to the drain, and it's as crude as that. So that's the first flushing toilet. There are sort of apocryphal stories that he installed one for the Queen, but we don't have any proof of that. But we really only have his written accounts of his design.
Bearing in mind this design by Sir John Harrington, is there any suggestion that the technology did find its way into being made from that point onwards, from the late 1500s?
Not immediately. I mean, there are two constraints here, perhaps the biggest one being piped water supplies. Michael talked a bit about the use of piped water in monastic settings, but it was very rare, even in the wealthiest households. a number of problems there. First of all, to have pipe water in a house, certainly you need a pump and header tanks and so on. And you also need pipes, and technology for making pipes was very crude. Water pipes were either made of wood or of lead, and it was really, really very low tech. And it was certainly not until the end of the 17th century that piped water supplies began to be introduced. Water-powered water pumps were being installed in a few places, and a few towns had piped water supplies, and a few houses had piped water supplies. Perhaps one of the earliest ones I know of is Blenheim Palace, which had a piped water supply of 1706. So houses didn't tend to have water on tap, if you like, to feed flushing toilets. And the other thing, of course, is you didn't generally have very good drains. So there's a question of where you got rid of the waste. So it was very slow to catch on because the technology really wasn't there to support it. The infrastructure wasn't there. We know from historical sources that there were a few grand houses installed water closets at the beginning of the 18th century. Chatsworth is perhaps a notable example. There were apparently 10 water closets in Chatsworth around the first decade of the 18th century. And Holcombe Hall in Norfolk, another one, they installed some in 1730. We don't know much about the design of these. They probably were very similar to John Harrington's, just a water tank and a bowl and a drain. We do know that the ones at Holcombe Hall were installed by a man called George Duval, who was known as the Royal Plumber. He had a business in London and did lots of work for nobility and for royalty, and installed toilets at Hampton Court Palace. But we don't know anything about the design of these.
So is it fair to say that Sir John Harrington is the first person to conceive of something that we would consider as a proto-lavatory?
Yes, I would say so. Yes, we certainly don't know of anybody else, any other named inventors in this field really until late 18th century, in fact. So he is regarded as the father of the flushing toilet.
And we start to get some new vocabulary coming in into this later period, don't we? Because you've talked about water closets. So this is different from garderobes. This is different from latrines.
Yes. So water closet is very specifically the use of flushing water to get rid of the waste. As I say, they were certainly in use the first half of the 18th century. But the big drawback with them really was there's no trap, there's no physical barrier to stop the smells coming from the drain. And obviously, as we were talking earlier, people throughout history have had an aversion to smells for good reason. So the closet that this was in would have been open to the drains, and so they smelt. So that was a drawback. You didn't want this in your bedroom, really. The big step change, really, solving this problem wasn't until 1775. A man called Alexander Cummings, who was a Scottish watchmaker, he designed a toilet bowl with what we'd call the U-bend, the water trap. So the water in the bend acted as a barrier from separated the toilet chamber from the drain, and so you didn't get smells. So that was a big step change. It was Alexander Cummings, 1775. But all of these designs, Cummings' design, going back to John Harrington's design, they had a valve which slid open to release the contents of the toilet pan, but it wasn't an airtight valve, which was why Cummings' water trap was a big step forward. So the later designs had a water trap and a valve, but the problem with the sliding valve was it got, shall we say, encrusted with waste, so it would stick, and it was difficult to clean. So the real person I would regard as the Rolls Royce of toilets for his day was a man called Joseph Brammer, who was a locksmith, lockmaker from South Yorkshire near Barnsley. And he set up business in London, he was famous for making safes and locks. And he had a showroom with a safe in it, and he challenged people to break into his safes and his locks. Quite an interesting character. But he patented a design in 1778, which had a tilting valve. So when you pulled the handle, the valve tilted and the water flushed the contents of the toilet bowl away, but it also flushed clean the valve, rather than the valve sliding to one side, which was what had happened up to that point. So that was quite important, because that really did make toilets, water closets then, much more popular, because they were more reliable and more hygienic. Interestingly, we know the first recorded example of Joseph Brammer's invention was at Audley End, English heritage property. They bought their first ones in 1775. So actually, they bought their first example before Brown had got his patent, and then they bought some more 10 years later, so they were very happy with those.
And you've mentioned, of course, a couple of properties where some of these early developments of flushing toilets can be found. Chatsworth House and Holcombe Hall, Chatsworth in Derbyshire, Holcombe Hall in Norfolk in East Anglia. Obviously, these aren't English heritage properties, but are there English heritage properties where we can see some early flushing loos?
Yeah, I should point out that there's no extant remains of these toilets in those properties. We just know from the accounts, from the historical records, if you like, that they installed them, but we don't have any physical remains. Brammer's design, it has been alleged to me, rumoured, that there is a Brammer toilet in the Houses of Parliament, but I've not been invited to the Houses of Parliament to inspect it, so I don't know whether this is true or not, or whether it's gone. Michael was talking about the monastic drainage system, and one of the interesting things at Audley End was that they retained use of, because the house is built on a monastic site, and they retained use of the monastic drainage system right through into the 19th century. And so some of these early toilets at Audley End were discharging into drainage sewage system, which was effectively medieval, put in by the monks. And as Michael described, there was a flushing system with a sluice valve, and every few weeks you would open the sluice valve and flush out the drains with water from the river to keep them clean. So that monastic practice was still in use at Audley End until the 19th century.
Speaking of the 19th century, we're into the Victorian period. How did the Victorians take toilet technology forward? And also, what were the reasons for these advancements?
So all of these toilets I've been talking about had metal pans, which were perhaps not as hygienic as they could be. So the next step forward was developed by a man called George Jennings in the 1840s, who designed a toilet with a ceramic, glazed ceramic bowl, very much like the ceramic bowls that toilets have today. And Jennings was an interesting character. He also pioneered the use of urinals and public conveniences, and he really came to fame, and his inventions came to prominence with the Great Exhibition in 1851, because Jennings was the man who provided all the toilets and the urinals at the Great Exhibition, which millions of people visited. And these public conveniences, you paid to use, and you paid a penny, and that was the first origin of the phrase spending a penny, because the public conveniences at the Great Exhibition, you had to pay a penny to use them.
Yes, and we should explain for anyone who doesn't know that phrase that spending a penny means going to the loo. So yes, I don't think everyone who's not British would appreciate that sort of nuance. But you're going to say as well?
Yes, so these toilets still all had valves. And so you pull the handle and the valve opened and the water flushed at the same time. And they were built into wooden cabinets, which were not the most hygienic things because waste could get trapped around the joints and so on. And the Victorians were notoriously obsessed with hygiene. So the next step came along around about 1860. And George Jennings was one of the pioneers of this. There's the freestanding ceramic toilet, which just didn't have a valve. It just had a water trap, a U-bend, and you relied on quite a force of water to flush out the waste around the U-bend and out. And these caught on in big time, really. Lots of companies were making these in the second half of the 19th century. Dalton, Twyford, Shanks, names that people will, certainly in Britain, will recognise that still exist to this day. And lots of different designs of these, all of them claiming to be better than their rivals. They needed quite a flush of water, which is why these toilets had what's called a high-level cistern. So the water tank was raised up to ceiling height to provide more force, downforce of water to flush out the waste from the round the bend. But these were freestanding, no cabinets, no working parts. So they were reliable, they were easy to clean, and they were caught on. And the water closet really became much more accepted, I think, in the second half of the 19th century. Having said that, these valve closets were still being made and in use right through to the end of the 19th century.
And you mentioned, of course, the various makers of porcelain ceramicware for toilets. One name that hasn't come up yet is Crapper, Thomas Crapper. How does this name fit into our story of toilets?
Yes. Yes, I once nearly lost a pub quiz because of this. And the question was, who invented the flushing toilet? And the answer they want, which they'd got off the internet, was Thomas Crapo, which caused a bit of an argument, I have to say. Crapo was an interesting character. He was a plumber in London, set up business in about 1860. And so he was 90 years after Cummins and Bramah that I was talking about earlier, and whole 250 plus years after Sir John Harrington. So he's a long way after being the inventor of the flushing toilet. But I think somebody wrote a fake biography of Thomas Crapper, which is somehow or other, particularly the Americans, have latched onto this idea that Thomas Crapper invented the toilet, and perhaps his name has something to do with it. But that's pure coincidence.
So he's just a plumber, that's all.
He was a very successful, he finished up running a very successful business. He started off as a plumber. He was a great marketeer, I think we would say these days. And he was the first in his line of business to open a Swish West End showroom showing off his sanitary wear. And so he attracted a lot of business from wealthy clients and royalty and so on. So he was very successful towards the end of the 19th century. And he did make some small designs, design improvements to toilets. He had some patents. And he was also an early pioneer of sewage treatment, which we're going to talk about in a minute. For example, there is an intact Thomas Crapper sewage plant at Ascot, which is a National Trust property, I'm afraid, in Buckinghamshire. So he supplied this complete sewage plant around the 1890s, which is one of the earliest surviving examples. So he was a far-sighted visionary, I suppose you would call him. He could see how to market his sanitary ware to a bigger audience and also the early adopter of the technology of sewage treatment. But as I said, along this time, other companies were still making the old-fashioned valve closets, and there are some examples of those surviving in English heritage properties in particular. Audley Ends didn't keep its Bramah toilets, but it has got some nice valve closets made by a company called Dent and Hellier. And there's another example I know of at Brodsworth, which is in Yorkshire, which has got a valve closet. For some reason, if you visit the English Heritage website, and there's a whole page about toilets there, they call it a thunderbox, the toilet at Brodsworth, which I think is a misnomer. Technically speaking, a thunderbox is a portable toilet that army officers carried around with them. It was just a portable commode, really. But because they were in a wooden cabinet and these valve closets were in wooden cabinets, then I think perhaps the term thunderbox has been attached to the Brodsworth example, probably erroneously. It's a very nice valve closet. I can't remember who made it. I think it might also be Dent and Hellier. But they were being made right up till the end of the 19th century, even though really the technology was a bit obsolete by then.
So between Sir John Harrington and this Victorian period, how was waste being disposed of ordinarily?
Quite simply, it was piped into the nearest watercourse. Perhaps not a problem if you were in a country house in the middle of nowhere, provided neither you nor your neighbours was using the same watercourse for your source of drinking water. But that wasn't really very good in urban areas. People might be familiar with the London cholera outbreaks in the mid-19th century, where supplies of drinking water were contaminated by human waste, which was just basically being dumped into the drains and seeping through the ground into the underground aquifers. So that was a recognition eventually in the 1850s of the connection between human waste and disease, really. And also in the 19th century, with all these new successful designs for water closets, for flushing toilets, people wanted them, people who could afford them, the burgeoning middle class households wanted a flushing toilet. It was a great status symbol rather than going out the back to an earth closet. And these water closets were just discharging into the ordinary drains, which were carrying surface water. So all of this filth was just being washed down into the streams, waters, into the rivers, which was clearly not particularly satisfactory. One of the famous sort of examples of this was what's called the London stink in 1858. All this human waste being dumped into the Thames, and it was a very hot summer, and it made the River Thames very smelly, so much so that the Houses of Parliament MPs in Parliament were overcome by the smell and decided something had to be done, in capital letters. So we start seeing the development of separate sewer systems, sewer pipes which conduct the foul water separately from rainwater and keep it separate. And then initially it was just being pumped away. So for example, in London, Joseph Bazalgette famously installed, designed and built this enormous sewer system to all the local sewers connected into the big sewers which ran along the side of the River Thames. And then the waste was just basically pumped downstream and pumped out into the river downstream of London. The waste is still being dumped into the river. It's just being dumped into the river in a more convenient spot.
A more controlled way that would ensure people's relative safety where they were living.
Yes.
So at what stage do we have water treatment works coming into being?
Really not until the end of the 19th century, after about 1870. One of the early ideas was that you basically just spread the waste onto open land and let nature take its course and let sunlight and everything, the air, sterilise the waste. That was actually coming back to Audley End again. They did that for a period at Audley End because they found that sewer waste was contaminating the water supply. So they put in a system whereby they pumped their waste up the hillside and spread it over and let it decompose. But you couldn't do that for a whole town, not for very long anyway. So at the end of the 19th century, science began to have its effect. And you start getting the evolution of sewage treatment plants. What they do is they store the waste in airtight tanks and let bacteria basically decompose the solid matter into liquid. And then the liquid waste is passed through a filter system, filter beds with coarse material like coke or broken bricks or something like that. It trickles onto this. And again, the action of the environment sterilizes the water, and what comes out at the end is effectively drinking water. All of that basic principle is still used today. The sewage digesters turn most of the wet solid waste into liquid, and then the liquid is treated and run into the rivers as treated water, you hope. I mean, there's lots of attention being given to untreated water going into the rivers, but in theory, what goes into the rivers is treated.
And I believe also that some of the solid matter can also be burned and turned into gas these days, or at least made into sort of fertilizer pellets.
Yeah, there are all sorts of green technologies. You can digest the waste. Some of the bacterial processes in digesting the waste generate methane. So you have a waste digester. Certainly this is what happens on farms. In some cases, you have a waste digester for the animal waste, and it's processed in sealed tanks, and it generates methane, which you can use to drive engines and generate electricity and so on. So that's one thing. All of these processes do leave some solid residue, which is sterile and can be used as fertilizer. So right back from the late 19th century, these sewage plants, most of the waste was turned into liquid form and treated, but there was still some solid residue, which would be cleared out and sold as fertilizer.
So as we sort of wrap up, Ian and Michael, obviously, to me, as a sort of outsider looking in, it seems that the history of human waste water management over the last 2,000 years or so is kind of one of blockages. We've kind of got the Romans, and then everything, all the technology gets lost, and then we sort of go down another path, sort of go backwards a bit, and then we start to develop new ways of managing waste. So yes, a story of blockages. Is that a sort of fair assessment, would you say?
Well, yes, two steps forward, one step back. I mean, that was true of lots of things. You know, for example, heating. The Romans had sophisticated heating systems, which we didn't start to emulate really until the end of the medieval period or even later. So that's a common story through history, really. Yes, not blockages of the sewage system, I would emphasise. I think that the big thing is the recognition, particularly from the 18th century, of the science and the connection between understanding the connection between what we now know as bacteria and disease, but also a strong aversion to smells. Michael was talking about earlier about the fact that perhaps people weren't in medieval times as clean as they became, and that was certainly a theme with Victorians, who became somewhat obsessed with fresh air and cleanliness.
You've been listening to the English Heritage Podcast. Next week, we stay with the subject of human health as we uncover the story and the man behind the NHS.
He came to it via his experience in Tredegar, where he chaired a local health insurance club where basically people paid in and they got free healthcare as a result of that. And that's essentially what we have on a national scale coming in.
Thanks for listening. See you next time.